I want to welcome you all to our session on Ottoman poetry. My name is Michael Sells. I teach in the Divinity School here in Islamic Literature and History. And before I introduce our speaker, I just wanted to mention that we have one more talk in this series, and that talk will be by Paul Lozinski, who is an alum of the University of Chicago, teaches at the University of Indiana, and he will be speaking on the topic of Hafez to Sayeb, imitation, competition, and creation in the Persian ghazal. And basically what these two talks are focusing on is the whole issue of nazire, the way that within a strong tradition where people, the audience for poetry knows the classics, often knows them by heart, there's a tradition of what's sometimes called imitation, but is much more than that, of taking earlier poems in the same rhyme, in the same meter sometimes, in the Persian and Ottoman traditions with a radif in which there's an intricate meter, not just a rhyme word at the end, but an intricate rhyme with some of the syntax before that, and engaging in a variety of appropriations, rivalries, reinterpretations of the earlier poems. And often some of the most interesting interpretations lie in the interface among those different poetic performances in the chain of naziras, so that the person hearing one poem is also hearing the other poem simultaneously and hearing them echo within and upon one another in a variety of ways. And our speaker today, Walter Zev Feldman, has been working on the Ottoman nazire for many years. He's done groundbreaking work on the way the nazire works within Ottoman, and also the way that the Indian style of Persian poetry and the Ottoman period poets have influenced one another and created a kind of symbiotic poetic world in the 17th century. I just want to say a few brief words about Walter. Walter is known for his book, Music of the Ottoman Court, Makam Composition, and the Early Ottoman Instrumental Repertoire. He's authored numerous articles on Ottoman poetry, including three ghazals of mid-17th century, The Celestial Sphere, The Wheel of Fortune and Fate in the ghazals of Naili and Balkhi. He's a musician who plays in a variety of musical contexts and is one of the people who continues the tradition of the sumbule, an instrument used by Eastern Jewish musicians that is related, as I understand, to the santur. I'd like to mention one other thing about Walter, in addition to the fact that he is now teaching half the year in Jerusalem at Bar-Ilan University. He lives in Jerusalem but teaches at Bar-Ilan in Tel Aviv and is a center of for the Jewish musical research at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's worked with UNESCO on the application of Mevlevi dervishes as part of the Masterpieces of Oral and Intangible Heritage of Humanity program. And he's done extraordinary work with a wide variety of topics within the culture of Ottoman Turkey, especially that go far beyond the court ghazal that he's going to talk about mostly today. One personal anecdote. A few years ago, I saw a wonderful article in the New York Times about a group of musicians from Uzbekistan who had moved to Queens and who were walking down the street with these extraordinary instruments I'd never seen before. And Walter was cited in the article as explaining that these were Uzbeks, Jewish Uzbeks who had moved to the United States after the fall of the Soviet Union and relocated to Queens, and that they were also inheritors of the court tradition of the Amir in Uzbekistan, and that they had mastered the repertoire of classical Persian, modern Uzbek, and other forms of poetry and song from the court tradition. I called Walter and asked him if there was any chance we could bring these musicians to Haverford College. And Walter agreed to work on that, and it was one of the most extraordinary events I've ever seen, only because the leader of the group, Ilyas Milayev, is an extraordinary poet and a musician and performer, but also because Walter was able to translate across 1,000 different forms of culture. The musicians spoke among one another in Russian. They recited poetry in classical Persian and Uzbek and several other languages. Walter was able to translate the poems, extraordinary translations for us at that time, so that we could have them from the Uzbek and classical Persian, and also able to explain the music, explain the dance, explain the cultural issues between the musicians from Bukhara and the dancer from Tashkent, explain what kinds of cognac and vodka the musicians would prefer, even though many of them did not drink, just a part of the general atmosphere. It's the kind of worlds, I think, that Walter inhabits that go beyond the kind of thing that can be shown in a list of articles and positions. So with great pleasure, I'd like to introduce Walter Zev Feldman.
Thank you, Michael. Are we on? Is this thing on? Yeah?
I think
is it on?
It's
not making any sounds when I tap it.
It's
not on. I don't think so. Yes, thank you. Well, I have very fond memories of that was a very wonderful period, actually, when the Bukharans began coming to the States and to Israel. And I've always had another life working with poetry, which Professor McMichael Sells has been a wonderful ear to share his ideas and translations. I have to apologize in the very beginning. I'm a bit of a shadow of myself because today is the first day when my spring allergies have struck. And my Ayurvedic doctor from Bombay, living in Ashdod in Israel, tells me to take nothing for it and just suffer. It's good for me. You know, I can have a long life. And indeed, I've known people living to their 90s who had this kind of allergy. But it's my luck that this is the first day where it appears. So, let's see now. You've heard something about the concept of the Nazire, and that's what has propelled me for years in working on this poetry, and I'm convinced it's actually the only way to understand what most of it is really about. This one I'll be speaking today is from an unpublished book, an unfinished and unpublished book that I started writing over 10 years ago, which is about the Nazire in the 17th century in Turkish. Sometimes dealing also with Persian poetry that was influential on the Turkish poets at the time. And this particular group of Nazires, and it's very important that I get through all of them because there is an argument here. So, and I want to end with Naili and begin with Alisher Nevai. Alisher Nevai was a very great poet in the Chagatai language, which is an older form of what's now called Uzbek. And he died in 1501. And his lyric poetry was very influential in Turkey. And it seems that this group of Nazires, which have the monorhyme of Paida, which means appeared in, it means a number of things in Persian, but this is the monorhyme that went through this whole series of poems up until the middle of the 17th century in Turkish. And I chose these because as I traced the development of this set of poems, which actually went from Herat, in what's now Afghanistan, to Baghdad, where Fuzuli was writing in the 16th century, to Istanbul and even Cairo, where Mezaki was writing in the 17th century, there's a to me, very unexpected development of themes. And I want to share some of this with you. Unfortunately, it means I'll have to give short shrift to some of the delicacy and detail of the poems. Yesterday, in Dr. Sell's class, I was able to spend a bit more time with the Turkish texts and talk in some more detail. And it would be fatal if I do that now. okay. So, I'll be doing a little bit of reading. I apologize. There'll be some reading and some talking. So, the Radif Payda blends the related but still distinct notions of appearance and creation or birth. So, verses that use Payda as appearance focus on what can be seen, what appears before our eyes, while Payda as creation focuses on something coming into existence. It's frequently used with our auxiliary verb in Persian or in Turkish. Now, as usual in Navai's lyric poetry, the tightly controlled points of similitude suggest subtle questions that urge the reader to look beyond the apparent meaning of each verse. In addition, Navai, like Babur and other Chagatai poets, but unlike most Ottoman poets, planned the order and function of the couplets, of the baits of their ghazals, whereby each bait developed the terms of the rhetorical figure employed in the previous one. It was usual for them to divide their ghazals into an opening and closing section divided by a central transition. And this is how Navai structured this ghazal with the Radif Payda. In distinction from such classical Persian poets as Saadi or Hafiz, or the classical Ottoman poets, Navai, who lived in the Timurid age where theoretical and institutional Sufism had a strong impact, not only on the general culture, but on the writing of poetry in particular. Like many of the ghazals in Navai's divans, this one can best be interpreted through a use of standard Sufi allegorical conventions and some idiolectic ones developed by Navai in his narrative poems, his Masnavis. Now, I think we should take a look briefly at the English translation. Although, alas, I won't be able to really give it the treatment I would like to here. You might look at the... just read through the English quickly. It's the first poem in your handout, Navai. Do we have extra handouts? It's my bad luck that this poem uses a structure which is the most complex of all of them. So again, I'm tempted to spend a whole hour talking about this poem, but that would be fatal. I'm going to make a few points about it. It's indeed very different than everything that came after. There is a deep allegorical usage here, which should be obvious, which makes this poem difficult, in fact, impossible to interpret on first glance. When you see, since you covered the rose leaf with fresh verdure, the sun's mirror is covered with rust. And then through longing for your ruby lips, Parts of my liver are afloat in my tears like a rose leaf in water. And again, I don't claim much for this English translation. It's very literal. We might suspect that there are several levels of meaning in this poem. One of them has to do with color imagery, because right away we see green, red rust, ruby, liver, tears, rose leaf, blood. We see then blood flows from my body, red, green. So then in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th verse, I died within the darkness of those locks without ever viewing her face. Alas, that dawn never appeared before my extinguished candle, where we have the image of the locks of the beloved, which is a sophistic allegory of the multiplicity of phenomena, hiding the unity of the divine face. But of course, we also have the color black, black for the hair. And in the end, well, he says, O wine bearer, my heart is constricted within the circle of sorrow of circling time. Why don't you make some wine appear so that it may expand once more? The soul's milk is hidden in Navai's pen. When will such sugar appear in every reed? So here we have a whiteness, a white imagery. I'll just say a few things about the colors. In the first bait, green, associations with life, rebirth, fertility, mystical gnosis, the figure of Khizr. The sun is described as a brass mirror whose face is obscured by greenish rust. The first line connects verdure with the rose leaf, springtime, rebirth. But the second misra explains green as the opposite, rust, hence old age, decline, disuse, leading to death. The color red is not mentioned explicitly, but it's probably implied by the image of the sun. If the sun, fire, red, is a source of life, then the green of rust is decline and death. In the second bait, green, the rose leaf, liver, life, red, bloody tears, ruby. Life and death mix as the green rose leaf flows like a corpse in water, life, while the poet's life, his liver, floats in the blood of his heart, tear. Life flows away. The red ruby symbolizes the dryness of fire, red, while when understood metaphorically as the lips, they are moist, hence they are life-sustaining. The red ruby completes the similitude of the red tear of the lover and the red lips of the beloved. In the third bait, red and green, red blood flows, arrows, like green leaves, sprout from the poet's body. But his death must lead to resurrection, rebirth in the spring. The fourth bait has no color, invisibility, and it's talking about invisibility. The fifth bait, black. This is where we talk about the black tresses. In the Masnavi, his Masnavi, Sabis Sayar, Sayara, Navai uses black to symbolize renunciation of the world. Hence the poet dies. In the conventional Sufi allegorisis, the black locks of the beloved symbolizes the multiplicity, kasrat, of the world, which obscures the brightness of the divine face. In the sixth bait, red wine, rejuvenation, health, expansiveness. In the seventh bait, white, both milk and sugar are white. In Seba Sayar, white is the color of purity, the color of the camphor taken by the minstrel. Well, it has to do with the story, but white is very important in Seba Sayar. Here, white is the color of the soul, hidden in the black pen, the reed of the poet. So, we see something is going on here, which can be interpreted either as mysticism, but there's a bit of the, let's say the, well, I want to simplify this. I'll read a few more commentaries. First bait. Throughout the first three baits, the colors green and red are in conflict. Green is the life of the natural vegetable world, or the vegetable soul, while red, fire, ruby lips, blood, wine, is the color of the source of mystical life, the true life of the mystic. While God has created man to be part of the natural world, this natural vitality is actually the cause for the diminution and near death of the sun of mystical life. Second bait. The poet, the mystic poet, must kill his lower self, his liver, a synecdoche for natural life, the rose leaf, so that through his soul, the bloody tears, he may attain the dry, burning red of the beloved's ruby lips. This is also the essential symbolism of the burning bush used in other Sufi-influenced ghazals. In Bait 3, when the mystic allows the beloved to slay him with her plant-like arrows, his blood, life, flows out, while the arrows become spiritual flowers on his lifeless body. The wounds, sources of pain and loss, become a source of pride, like a flowering garden. In Bait 4, the poet mystic learns the impossibility of grasping the invisible waist of the beloved and leaves all colors for invisibility. The image of the thin waist introduces an erotic element that predominates for the next two baits. Bait 5, the earthly poet mystic is dead to the world, black. Bait 6, the red wine will revivify him like the red fire of the mystical sun of the ultimate truth. Bait 7, the poet mystic, purified of all worldly lusts, attains to the white purity of the soul. Perhaps also for the poet, writing is the only way he can purify his soul. He renounces the world through the blackness of his pen, which allows the whiteness of his soul to emerge. In reading a ghazal such as this, it's difficult not to integrate our knowledge of the author as a sophistically oriented intellectual and a great writer of Masnavi narratives. It is as though Navai was unwilling to allow the ghazal to go on as a lyric form. Rather, the traditional imagery and language of the ghazal become a vehicle for an all-encompassing systematic thought, integrating the poet's personal passion with the aspiration she shares with all writers of poetry within his culture. To treat each and every bait of a ghazal as such a vehicle, clearly announcing an elaborate allegorical scheme for interpretation, is alien to the later Ottoman tradition, as it seems to have been for the earlier Persian tradition. We lack textual evidence for how the Ottomans read ghazals like this one. Yet, Navai remained a fundamental classic for the Turks, both Ottomans and readers of the Turkmen-Turkish language of Iran and Iraq. And that's why my next stop will be Baghdad and looking at a ghazal of Fuzuli. In fact, when we go on to Istanbul, we'll see that the Ottomans seem to have gotten a lot out of the strategy that Navai used in this ghazal, although they didn't imitate it. They imitated the technique, they imitated some of the form. Now, the next ghazal is by...
Well,
yes?
One thing, for some of you who see the handouts late in the second set, they're missing the complication, so if you don't see it, that's why. That's all right.
Okay. Now, Fuzuli, who died in 1555, was born in Baghdad, and he wrote in the form of Turkish that's used in Iraq, Iran, and the South Caucasus, which nowadays is called Azerbaijani. Then sometimes was called Turkmen. And the Ottoman Tezkere writers always mention that he's very much influenced by Navai, and his style of writing is something between... for example, so I quote some of the Ottoman writers saying, he is remembered in connection with speech like Navai among the Turks and Mongols. He chose an artistic style between Navai and Turkish. And his works were well known in Turkey. Now, Fuzuli wrote a number of nazires to poems by Navai. It seems that several Ottoman poets were aware of both of these poems, that's to say, Navai's poem and Fuzuli's poem with the Radif Payda, and used them in writing their nazires. There are major formal differences between the poems by Fuzuli and the poem by Navai. Navai's ghazal is fully what they call muselsel, in chain, completely monothematic. That's to say, each bait is connected with the previous bait. Fuzuli's strategy implies a development of an argument, a progression of poetic matrices. And I'll just read a bit of it in Turkish and in English. Behold your hidden essence from whose mystery the world of phenomena appeared. Upon the ocean of your creative act, from the depths of non-existence, waves appeared. In Turkish, Zihi zatın nihani ol nihandan ma siva peyda. Bahari sunnunga emvaj peyda ka'ar inna peyda. From high and low, the world witnessed the emanation of your being. It was not in vain that out of nothing the earth and sky appeared. Bülendü pest alem şahidi feyzi vücudun değil bihude olmak yok iken arzu sema peyda. In order to manifest your power from the dark dust, the substance of your wisdom caused the world revealing mirror to appear. The mirror of the world reflects both your anger and your graciousness, and thus at times it is sorrow, at times joy that appears. At times your wisdom buries 1,000 moon-faced beauties in the earth. At times your creative act causes 1,000 moon-faced beauties to appear. In Turkish, Gehi toprağı ve eyler hikmetin bin mehlika pinhan. Gehi sünün kılır toprakdan bin mehlika peyda. So that the secrets of your knowledge would not remain hidden from the people of the world, your wisdom caused the prophets among the unbelievers to appear. In the last verse, it's a mark of your solicitude that in order to speak your praises from Fuzuli's dark nature, a soul-expanding word has appeared. Now, this is a very different poem from Navai's, where Navai had employed the traditional strategy of shifting the addresser and addressee. Fuzuli retains the same ones throughout. Where Navai varied his tone among the devotional, the mystical, and the emotional voice of a lyric poet, Fuzuli never swerves from the devotional tone set in the very first bait. The development of color symbolism in each bait of Navai forces the reader to ponder a hidden meaning, not obvious on the basis of the imagery alone. But Fuzuli speaks with utter clarity and transparency, using key words that structure the entire message. All the words are well known and used in their standard meanings. This is an extremely clear, evident poem. This is his strategy. He uses words wisdom, knowledge, divinity, emanation, manifestation, creation, power, joy, sorrow, anger, mirror, heaven, world, earth, hiddenness, darkness. These are the key words. And there's no question really about the meaning of any of them. I won't dwell on this poem. It's a wonderful poem. I love this poem. I think it's a beautiful poem. The question is, what did the Ottomans make of it? And none of the Ottoman poems that we'll see coming up seem to refer to anything of Fuzuli except for his last bait, where he talks about the divine solicitous in enabling him to produce a wonderful gem out of his dark nature. This idea appeared. So, I might add, there are virtually no images or tropes in the poem. The few that do appear are transparent. The ocean of the creative act, the abyss of non-existence, dark dust, secrets of knowledge, soul-expanding word. Yet each one seems full of expressive power. Thus, while avoiding most of the structure, the special syntax, imagery, and lexicon of the Ghazal genre, Fuzuli has created a poem possessing enormous grandeur and emotional effect. He achieves this not despite, but largely because of its devotionalism and didacticism. The poetic eye is nowhere to be seen until the signature verse, where it carries great power as the poet denies his own genius while pointing to the brilliant words that have emerged from him. In the finest epideictic style, he merges himself with the divine will and the wisdom of the creative act, which he can never hope to comprehend. Unlike Navai, he seeks no place for mystical love as a means of approaching the divine or purifying the carnal soul. Ishq, or other words for love, never appear, even once, in the entire poem. So Fuzuli also avoids any symbol that would attach and limit his vision to any sectarian view, whether Sufi, Shia, or even Islamic per se. His vision here is monotheistic in the broadest sense. Now, when we get into the Ottoman culture, properly speaking, and remember, Fuzuli was not part of the Ottoman culture, properly, although he was appreciated by the Ottomans, the first poet I chose, where I found the Peyda Redif, and here it's Er Peyda. This is your, let's see now, would be your next example. I think you have the Turkish as well. You have English. Where is my English? Is Hayali number three?
Hayali is number three, and then the Turkish handout has the collective ones in Turkish. So on number three, it starts at the bottom of the page and goes on to the next page.
So. A little cramped. Okay. Now, about him. Hayali Bey was the most influential Ottoman poet of the first half of the 16th century. His poetry represents a synthesis of the Ottoman courtly style with a heterodox Sufi literary trend. This synthesis was largely eclipsed by the courtly style of the ulema poets, beginning with Baki, but later would have a profound effect on the so-called Indian style of the 17th century. Hayali himself lived through this blend of cultural milieu emerging from a Turkish military background in Macedonia. And we have something about his biography. Ali Nihat Tarlan, the famous student of Fuad Korpulu, wrote quite a bit about Hayali, whose divan he edited. And he mentions that the renowned Hayali, or the well-known Hayali, as he was described in the Tezkeres, was buried in the dust. In the following century, it was always Baki who occupied the highest place. So, and he would actually, Ali Nihat Tarlan emphasized Hayali, and he was very interested in this alternate trend in Ottoman poetry, which was much more integrally Sufistic, and which was not usually patronized by the court after the middle of the 16th century. Now, I just look at, if you look at the translation, Hayali, by the way, was a contemporary of Fuzuli, whom he met personally when Suleiman's army occupied Baghdad in 1534. And he said, the Turkish here, Gören nazmım oyunundan eder huni ciger peyda. Nice kanlar yutar kan eyleyince bir güher peyda. The reader of my verse weeps bloody tears. How much blood must he swallow to become a mine and produce a gem? And then he goes on to talk about Farhad. Now, Farhad is an important mythical figure in this poetry. He and Ali Shernavai had written a Mesnevi about him, Farhad al-Shirin. And this, in brief, the story is that as this is Farhad is a craftsman who is in love with a princess with whom the Shah is also in love. So Farhad has to do impossible tasks like boring through a mountain in order to impress the princess Shirin. And this image is used over and over again in Ottoman poetry, as we'll see, as a symbol of the artist, in other words, the poet. And all the poets that we see now will start to refer to Farhad. So in the second verse, Farhad the madman adorned the throne of the kingdom of love. Is it any wonder that Mount Bidhistun girded his loins with belt and sword? Now, who remembers what is Mount Bidhistun? This is the Mount Rushmore of the Achaemenid Persian culture. No, not Alborz. Yes? No, it's earlier than that. I know you're thinking of a Sasanian monument, yes? This is an Achaemenid monument.
Achaemenid Reis?
See?
Yeah, Achaemenid Reis.
Yes, that's right. That's right, yeah.
But they're
conflating these two things. But in any case, it's the mountain that the mystic and in this case the poet has to pierce. And he goes on talking about himself in the deserts of love, and then look at the last verse. in Turkish, Hayali hilkatum, Hayali hilkatum den bir melek ru aşikar oldu. Nitekim zulmeti şebde olur nakah kamer pe. O Hayali, from your nature, an angel faced beauty has come to light, just as suddenly the moon appears in the dark of night. So, by the standards of the 17th century, this gazelle is not fully unified, not fully yek or henk, as they said then, not of one melody, but its speaker is nevertheless one. The I is prominent in all verses except the second, and this I never addresses a you. There is no obvious beloved in the poem. The absence of the beloved also removes the face imagery, cheeks, dimples, brows, eyes, glances, etc. Likewise, the basic ecology of the gazelle, the garden, the flowers, and birds are absent. But what he's talking about, he begins the poem with poetry. The poet produces his verses like a mine produces precious stones through the condensation or pressure on his heart's blood. And then he goes on to talk about Farhad, who was rewarded for his labor on the mine, mountain mine, in the kingdom of love. In the end, he says, a beautiful luminous verse has emerged out of the dark nature of my ego. The matla, that's the first lines, that refers to the poet's own verse, not only to poetry in general. This prominent reference to the ability of the poet is more expected in the signature, not the beginning. Hayali begins his poem not with love, which appears in verse 2, as Ashk and Muhabbet in verse 3, but with poetry, Nazm. This prominence of the I as the poet, my verse, which is quite shocking, really, my verse, may perhaps be explained as part of the Nazir, a writing technique, as a response to Navai's strategy of making poetry a central part of the scheme of purification for the poet as mystic. Hayali indeed had begun his career as a dervish before becoming a poet. Now revelation, emergence. Well, let me go back to Fuzuli perhaps. It is in the signature verse where Hayali shows the clearest allusion to one of his two predecessors. He faces Fuzuli squarely. The dark nature of the Turkmen poet becomes the nature, hilkat, of the Ottoman poet. And we understand this nature is also dark because of the image of the moon emerging out of the darkness of the night. Hayali stresses the emergence of the hidden with the word ashikar, open revealed, which is almost equivalent to peyda. Hayali's angel-faced beauties seem to be an allusion to the moon-faced beauties of Fuzuli. Revelation, emergence, coming to light are all key concepts in the poem. In the first bait, bloody red tears emerge out of the dark recesses of the liver through the luminous eyes of the reader and the poet. Bright jewels, traditionally red rubies, emerge out of the darkness of the mountain. In bait 4, a concentration of words expressing light and radiance cancel out the opening imagery of the dark interiority. The theme of coming to light receives a grand treatment in the signature verse. Beauty transcends the natural darkness of the poet's human nature. Fuzuli attributes this to God's solicitousness, shafkat, which does not imply any inherent link between creator and creature. Man's ability to create beauty is a gift. Perhaps because Hayali has already lost his ego in the overwhelming brightness of the divine self-revelation, there is no explicit reference to God here. Fuzuli had spoken in theologically orthodox terms. Hayali approaches the issue of existence from a more overtly Sufi mystical viewpoint. God's existence as the creator separate from his creation cannot leave adequate room for human artistic creativity. Hayali opens his poem with the struggle of the human poet to produce the gem from within the deep recesses of his dark carnal nature, until this nature loses itself in the struggle and is ultimately eradicated by the flood of light emanating from the divine self-revelation. This struggle of the poet mystic lover to reveal the new luminous divine element in his dark human nature, transforming it into light, became a fruitful theme for the Ottoman poets of the 17th century. And now we turn to Cevri. who is, what number is he? I don't think I have the clue. And the Turkish. In English, at that time, when the passionate desire for your precious ruby had produced no trace upon my heart, no gem had yet emerged from the mine of non-existence. And he goes on, if the rubies of your lips have manifested pearls and gems, my eyes as well have produced a fresh ruby from my heart's blood. And he says in Turkish, dilim de olmuşi ken şeftilalümden eser peyda. Dahi kani ademden olmamıştı bir güher peyda. Senin lali lebin dürü gerherler zahir eylerse, benim de çeşmim eyler huni dilden laliter peyda. Now, the words. I have here in this chapter a chart of the lexical relationships between Cebri and Hayali and Nevai, where we can see that in each bait, Cebri is usually referring directly to Hayali, sometimes to Nevai, sometimes directly as Eser Peyda, that this something came to light. He quotes Nevai directly in the first verse. The word kan for mine, he's quoting directly from Hayali in the first verse. And he quotes Hayali directly, Goher Peyda, a jewel came into existence. This is a quote from Hayali. And every bait in Cebri, he's quoting some lexical item from either Nevai or Hayali. So we see how this, on the technical level, that this is certainly Nazire. So the words alone suggest that Cebri has created Nazire of a very close type, rather than the loose treatment of themes that connect Nevai, Fuzuli, and Hayali. Now, as you can see, the themes of the mine, of the gem, the ruby lips, right, which we remember from Hayali, this is how Cebri is beginning. And he is indeed talking about by the way, Cebri was a Mevlevi and very much attached to the Mevlevi order in Istanbul. So he is here creating a unity of himself speaking as a dervish and speaking as a poet. And the there is no other emphasis. I like for 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth verse, on the last judgment's morn, the eye of the lover would not open from the sleep of sorrow, if in this world no dawn had arisen following separation's night. What is he getting at? See, and I think my interpretation here, Cebri turns to Nevai, who, if you remember the fourth verse, let's go back to the first poem, the Nevai. Look at the fourth verse of Nevai. Can someone read that? I'm not sure I can find it so quickly. Ah, no. The fifth verse, sorry, the fifth verse of Nevai. Michael, can you read the fifth verse of Nevai?
I died.
Yes, I died.
I died. Within the darkness of those locks, without ever viewing your face, alas, that dawn never appeared before my extinguished candle.
Yeah. So what I think is that here in Cebri's fourth verse, he's turning to Nevai's fifth. Cebri turns to Nevai, who allows his poet lover to expire without ever seeing the dawn of union. But Cebri says no. The lover will never attain eternal life if he has not experienced love in this world, bu dünyada, in this world. In the context of the poem, this must refer to the lover primarily as poet, reinforcing Navai's theme of self-purification through poetry. Djevri implies that this self-purification must take place in this life through the struggle with art. We can go back to the second verse of Djevri. Yes. And here, the poet had to undergo a creative process. My bloody tears had to be pressed into a ruby. In some sense, this act of creation is analogous to your scattering pearls and gems from your ruby lips, here addressing the divine beloved. The conditional clause is part of colloquial speech. If your ruby lips had done X, then mine too, Benimde, had done Y. The informality of the language, plus the identity of the terms referring to lover and beloved, constitute a bold statement. The poet can only cause the poem to emerge out of non-existence by adding his own effort in the mind of his own being to his passion for the beloved. Now, in the end, we see an image. Oh, here we have English translations. Last verse of Djevri. O Djevri, were bloody tears to flow from my eyes, sparks would leap from the ocean, heated by love's fire. And this is an image which we'll see will be developed later. But let us turn to Mezaki. Mezaki is your last English example, number 6. We will come back for Naili. Mezaki is generally not considered to be a poet on the same level as Djevri, Haili, or Naili, a good poet. However, he had the most successful career of any of them. He simply stuck to the bureaucracy and had an extremely successful career, mostly in Egypt. He himself was of Bosnian origin, had good connections in the army, therefore, and was a very successful bureaucrat for most of his life and attended several military campaigns in Crete and in Austria. But he had the time to write a huge divan, and he also was attached to the Mevlevi Dervish order. And in his divan, we see that he's often writing nazires to Djevri and to Hayali. And here we see an emphasis on art and love. And I have 4 verses of this. I didn't translate all of them. These are 4 verses. What a strange valley of bewilderment, this wilderness of love. It has no fellow traveler, no road in sight, and no guide appears. Majnun's ability to love is innate. He plays a lover's ambush. But what wondrous work he can accomplish when his artful mind appears. Art memorializes love and lover. The farhad of non-existence is blind, but the image of Mount Bisistun appears. O Mezaki, in this monastery of signification, the melodious scratching of my many-hued pen makes the organ's tone to appear. I rest my case. So what are we talking about now? We've really shifted our attention clearly to art. So Mezaki represents the apotheosis of art in the Mevlevi Dervish tradition. Art is the visible or audible form of love, created by a combination of love and intellect. Now mind you, intellect, akal, and love, ishq, had been regarded as antitheses by the earlier Sufi poets in Turkish or Persian. In Hafiz, akal, intellect, is the enemy of love. But if we look at the Turkish text of Mezaki, you don't have the Turkish text of Mezaki. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Yes, in the Turkish, the third verse, Kemin bazi çe-i mecnun mader zad-i ishq ancak ne kar ibul acab itse bu akli zulfunun peyda. So he has these words, akıl, from intellect, and zulfunun, meaning full of skill, full of art. And so this is something new, actually. This is something certainly new in Turkish poetry. where there's a combination of intellect and skill, which are now connected with love. So in a sense, they see this creation, and he uses the word yadigar, monument. Right? There's a he uses the word huner, skill. Huner ish ile ashik bir eser le yad olmaktır. This is where is the English? Yes, the English. Art memorializes love and lover. Right? This is quite huner ish ile ashik bir eser le yad olmaktır. He uses the word for lover and love together in the same line, and the word huner, meaning skill or art, and the word eser. Eser is a work of art. So this is very, very blatant and quite new for Turkish literature. And of course, he's making this wonderful reference to the Christian religion and culture by referring to the organ and the deir, which is referred usually to a monastery, a Christian monastery. So by combining the monastery and the organ, he's out of the sphere of Islamic culture. He's actually in a universalist mode here. Now, I will close, as I promised you, with Naili. And Naili was not a happy camper. Naili was a universal pessimist. A contemporary of Cebri and of Mezaki. And he begins, "As my heart's fire-shouting sea calms down within my body, each wound of longing causes a bloody whirlpool to appear." Now, if we remember, he's quoting Cebri, because Cebri had ended his ghazal with, can we go back to Cebri? We see Cebri, the previous page, number 4. "O Cebri, were bloody tears to flow from my eyes, sparks would leap from the ocean, heated by love's fire." This is a, Naili is referring back to Cebri. But for for Cebri, basically it had a rather optimistic poem until then. Although, because there's a great struggle for the artist mystic to create a work of art. But eventually he will create it. And in fact, Cebri is saying that there's no future for this artist mystic in the world to come if he hasn't done something in this world. That's what Cebri is saying. Whereas Naili doesn't give us much hope. He goes on to say, "From end to end, this world is a mountain of suffering and woe. With each pickstroke of desire, yet another behistun appears." And we can leave the next two verses, which are another kind of imagery. We have a kind of love imagery here, not entirely negative, it's true. But in the end, where does Naili leave us? "O Naili, in this circus tent, the greatest wisdom is to know from under which patch cloak the 7 blue bowls will appear." This is nasty. So, now what do we think? What are these blue bowls? The spheres, right? The spheres that enclose us, that represent our destiny. And to him, all this destiny business, it's the same as a circus performer. That the owner of destiny is just sorting out these bowls for us. You get this one and you get that one, and how do you know what's going to come from behind my back? And that you don't. So what he says here, "O Naili, in this circus tent, the greatest wisdom is to know from under which patch cloak." And by the way, the patch cloak is also associated with the dervish. That's the mark of the dervish. And he uses the word hırka in Turkish, which is the mark of the dervish, the humble patch cloak. But here he's using the dervish as a symbol of the circus charlatan. So in Turkish he says, "Bu lu'bet gahda," which means the circus. "Bu lu'bet gahda, ey Naili, bilmektedir hikmet." Hikmet, wisdom, which for Fuzuli was a big word. Hikmet was divine wisdom. But here it's something that you've got to be sharp to know what's going on in the circus. Bu lubet gahda eynaili bilmektedir hikmet. Ne ziri hırkadandır heft tas nil gül peyda.
Right, so you've got to know from where this charlatan dervish is going to give you your fortune. That's wisdom. That's hikmet. So we can conclude this, and of course, Naili is the beginning of a long cycle of what I would call post-Sufi poetry, which in Turkish actually was flourishing until the end of the 19th century. And this is something that has almost no research as far as I know, but there was a strange train going from Naili, a very cynical, what I would call post-Sufis, that continued to write in this style until the end of the 19th century, certainly. Ziya Pasha has some poems in this style as well. But to go back to Naili, Naili has lost faith in, one, the Ottoman Islamic political structure, and for its lack of a proper recognition for poets. That's a very important part. That's to say, all the Ahayali Bey and Cevri and Mezaki are talking about the importance of the struggle with art as part of the struggle of the mystic. Now, Naili gave up on struggling with art for any kind of worldly success, and he was, in a sense, fed up with that. So he's given up on that. Two, he's given up on the mystical Sufi interpretation of reality and of the special gnosis available to mystics. Three, he's given up on the ability of the poet to purify his soul through art. And four, he's also given up on the traditional system of resemblances, the nasub, that underlie the poetic system. Now, maybe this is a lot to read into one poem. Of course, I've been studying Naili for many years, so this includes many other poems of Naili. But what I would say is that Naili chose this poem with the Redif Peyda, which he knows goes back to Fuzuli and Navai, and which was used recently in his own lifetime by Cevri and Mezaki, to extol the virtue of art as part of a mystic path. And he's just assaulting them. He's assaulting Cevri, and it would have been understood this way. For him to write poetry of this kind, it's an assault on Cevri, his contemporary. And there is, by the way, in the book here, I have a long quotation from Haluk İpekten, who edited Naili's Divan, and İpekten gives a rather sophistic interpretation of every bait in this poem. But it's something that's entirely lexical and has no context, and also doesn't refer to the reality of this poem being a nazire to other poems. And again, if you only read one poem, you'll never understand the full meaning of that one poem. So that's why I read this poem, in a sense, as an assault on the others. Now, to go back to Cevri finds himself in essential agreement with Hayali, which hark back ultimately to Navai. Hayali Bey refers both to Fuzuli and to Navai. Fuzuli is writing a divine panegyric, which refers to himself as the artist only in the Takhallus, at the end. The only Sufi concepts that he used are the ones which already were accepted into Orthodox Islam. And Navai is writing within the artistic Sufi style of the Timurid period, where both the rules of rhetoric and the beliefs of Orthodox Sufism were apparent in virtually every line that he wrote. So the conclusion, I would say, that to understand these poems, whether they're in Turkish or other Turkic languages, Turkmen or Chagatai, we need to approach the structure and imagery which was used in each era and in each sub-language within Turkish. Two, to try to understand the literary emphasis of each individual poet. Three, to try to identify the response of the individual poet to the general literary heritage, whether in Turkmen, Chagatai, Ottoman Turkish, or Persian. And then to look at their individual attitudes toward poetry as an art and to Sufism, to mysticism, and their place within that constellation. And of course, the Nazire is the best means to, it's a shortcut to try to understand these things about these poets and the poems. I think I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Walter. We will have now time for questions, and we can go up until 6 o'clock, however long the questions go. I want to say that once the questions are over, I would like everyone who wishes to stay and chat, not to stay in this room, but to go downstairs to the common room on the first floor, the major room on the first floor toward the chapel, where there's a reception set up, so that after the question period is over, I will try to lead Walter right down there so that people can pursue their discussion downstairs with the refreshments. And I'll leave people to address the questions directly to Walter, if that's okay.
Yes, back there.
Yeah. What are the, and not to ask over the precise detail, what are the death dates of these, or the days of these poets left? Like what sort of periods began?
Well, I thought I sort of announced that, for maybe not for all of them. Navai lived in the second half of the 15th century, died at the beginning of the 16th. Fuzuli and Khayali were contemporaries, and they flourished in the first half of the 16th century. Then you have another, that's one group, right? Those, although they were living in different cities. Khayali lived in Istanbul, and Fuzuli lived in Baghdad. Then the next group are Istanbul poets, Cebri, Naili, Mezaki, although Mezaki spent much of his life in Cairo, and he was not born in Istanbul, he was from Bosnia. But they all knew each other and were part of the same sort of cultural circle. And these were people of the mid-17th century. I can give you exact dates. I know Naili died in 1666, Cebri somewhat before, and Mezaki in the 1670s. Am I skipping somebody? No. Yeah. Yes, please.
I have two questions.
Uh-huh. Well, part of this, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, and the other thing is that apparently, I mean, this radif or this rhyme is, I think it's a common thing to the Persian.
In Persian poetry, yeah.
Well,
yeah. Actually, in other poems, I do go into Persian, where I know that, for example, the one I didn't really speak much about yesterday, but the ones that have the radif imast in Persian, imizdur in Turkish, not a radif, it's a rhyme in Turkish. There I mention Urfi and Saib because I know they were very influential on my 17th century poets. This study began as a study of 17th century Turkish poets. So where I know, and of course they were interested primarily in the Persian poets of India. So in these 17th century poets, I of course always look what's in the Divan of Urfi, what's in Sayyid, what's in Kalim, because they often are ultimately referring to a poem in Persian from India. This group of poems I saw as coming, this one's with Peyda, it seemed to me they're coming from Chagatai and Turkmen. These were the two sources for them. But of course, a broader study, it wouldn't hurt to look and see what Persian poems are using this. Sure. There are also other poems. Navai has two poems with Payda as a radif, but it's only one of them that seems relevant to the later tradition, the one that I talked about. But of course, the wider the better. The wider the better. Yeah. Oh, Navai, yes, and you're right. Okay, well, this is my interpretation of him as a writer. I did a study of part of his, he has a Khamsa, a five Masnavis. Yeah, Saba Sayara. And in that, I think that's a lot of what's going on there. That's a lot of his attitude. And that's really his, let's say, his persona was that. You see it in many of his poems, and you see it in his Masnavis. That's to say, he was a poet, he was a statesman, he was a poet, and thought of himself very much as a mystic. And in his writing, you see these elements merge together in a way that's, let's say, not as obvious, I think, in some other earlier writers. But in Navayi, it's very obvious. He's a dense writer, you know, because, as I tried to say at the beginning, this style of, on the one hand, the style of rhetoric and the style of using allegory on many levels was not fashionable by the Ottoman period. He's very different than the Ottoman poets. So the Ottomans got things from him, but they certainly didn't want to imitate his style of his poetic strategy. Also the fact that in his time, the verses of a ghazal had an order and a logical development, which they generally did not adhere to. So again, the literary climate had changed very much. They also didn't imitate his Mesnavis either. They were not influential so much. They were even criticized by the Ottomans later on. There was something they got from him, but there isn't a straight line of development from his poetry into Ottoman poetry, certainly not. Yeah. It's a good question. Yeah.
I have a question. I was struck by, was it Bezaki or Jeffrey who talked about Majnun as an artist using Afa?
Yes, that's Mezaki.
Mezaki.
Yeah.
Of all the, I guess I'm used to the ghazal Nazir is overturning one another, overturning images, turning around and offering different views of things, but and complete freedom on the theological level to talk about a variety of things. But some things seem sacred. And that Majnun, a wet love man, and lost his aku, seems like the founding myth.
That's right.
So it really struck me that Mezaki would view Majnun of all people as the artful intellect, if you have any further comments on that, have you ever seen that anywhere else?
No, it's very rare. I think it's only hinted at by Cebri. But again, this is my guess really, and I would like to pursue it further. That this is part of the Mevlevi culture of the 17th century. These both Cebri and Mezaki were Mevlevis, were involved with the Mevlevi order. And you see a new concern for the work of art in every form. And Cebri was a calligrapher, professional calligrapher. And as we know, the Mevlevis, they took much of the place of the court, when the court was quite weak in the 17th century and was not able to patronize art very well. The Mevlevi order began to assume that function in some ways. And in music, they were absolutely crucial. They had a parallel tradition of music, parallel to the courtly music. And so, and the first, like the earliest compositions that we know of where the composers are remembered is the 17th century. In fact, contemporary with Cebri and Mezaki. We have Mustafa Dede, who died in 1683, is the first known composer of the Mevlevi ritual music, the Ayin. And the fact that his name was remembered, and his music is, through the oral tradition, the music continued. When I write about Mevlevi music, I make this point that the Mevlevis were very concerned with the individual style of the composers. They wouldn't recompose a piece that had been partly forgotten. Whereas in secular music, there was no question. If a piece was partly forgotten, the later musicians would recompose it and add sections. The Mevlevis wouldn't do that. There was something for them sacred about the form in which the musician had composed the piece, even if it had been partly forgotten. So I think it's a new emphasis on the importance of art and this connection of, and of course they were mystics, that was what they did. So it's a new and very explicit connection of art and mysticism. Now, we might say that in Islamic culture this was there for many centuries. Of course it was. But what I see that's new in the 17th century Turkish literature, that poets start to refer to it more directly
And that's my interpretation of Djebri when he says, Budunyada, in this world. That something has to be done. And with constant showing of this parallel of the mystic creating the gem from within his breast, parallel with the ruby lips of the divine beloved, this is also rather new and quite bold. And I agree with you, for Mezaki to connect Majnun with intellect and skill is shocking. It overturns the whole mythology of Sufism. So we have to ask ourselves, why would he do that? Why would he do that? So to me, this reinforces my theory, really, that there was a trend among Sufis and among poets to see poetry as a spiritual path. And so if after several centuries of writing in this way, a poet like Mezaki can be bold enough to say, well, I am like Majnun. I am a mystic. I am a lover. But I'm also an artist. And as an artist, I need my intellect. I need my akal and I need my skill, my huner. And in the end, we'll have an eser, we'll have a work of art, which, as he says, memorializes ishq and ashik, memorializes love and lover. That's new. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yes, please.
No. Well, of course, to be able to do this, ideally, we would like to be able to date the poems, and we can't. We can't. In some cases, we can guess which poem may have been prior. And this is a complex argument, where we just go to how the language is used and what seems to be referring to what, and in which bait certain references occur. It's also partly subjective. But I have this. But you know, let's say Djebri produced many, many poems on this line, and Naili produced many, many poems on his line. That is to say, that the attitude we see in Naili, which is very negative, very pessimistic, is pretty much a constant throughout almost all of his ghazals. Whereas Djebri's point, which is optimistic and engaged, sort of mystically and artistically engaged, that characterizes almost all of his poems. Occasionally, I've seen Djebri become cynical. He has a wonderful poem, which I quote in that article about Nazire in the Turkish Studies Association Bulletin, where he gets fed up and talks about how we should just write anything that will sell. And the redif of the poem is satalum, which in Turkish means let us sell. It's a unique document. It says, let us sell anything that these boobs will buy. You know, let us sell. Let us sell wisdom. Let us sell prose. Let us sell, you know, pretending that the ugly is beautiful and the beautiful ugly. Let's just sell. Yeah. I was sure. Why would they not? I mean, this was an audience of very erudite people, and certainly, well, the older classics, Navai and Fuzuli, of course, are well known. There were many, many copies of these divans in Istanbul. Certainly, in fact, they knew very recent poetry from India. They were aware of what was being written in Delhi very, very soon after it was written there. So this we also know. It's more of a question as to who knew what the Turks were writing outside of the Ottoman Empire. See, that hasn't been well researched. And we know that in Iran, of course, the ruling classes were Turkish-speaking at this time. So there's very little evidence, and it's never really been properly studied, to what extent anything written in Istanbul would have been known in Iran or in India. But the influence the other way was very strong.
Yeah.
Well, this I'd like to talk to you further about. Yeah. Yes, please. Yes. Sure. Yeah, I mean it's not unknown. Of course, it's possible tropes, but one wonders why he chose to use it here. You know, I don't have a full answer for this. You know, what was the I haven't seen so many references to have any theory really as to why this was useful for him, but what it does do on the surface, he's not constricted anymore by any kind of, dogmatic restriction when he goes as far as to talk about the monastery and the organ, which I know he has a right to do. It's already a poetic trope, but again, it seems to suit his purpose to go without outside of the Islamic sphere in this case.
Yeah.
Well, look, I've never made a study of the Erganun in Arabic, whether they were referring to Franks originally or to Byzantines. Byzantines had Erganun. They had some kind of organ, which they didn't use in church, apparently. But again, as a musicologist, this is a bit earlier than the era that I specialize, or the period that I specialize in. But there must be a reason why Erganun would appear originally in Arabic and what it originally referred to. But in this case, this is a good 700 years later in Turkish. So again, I'm not sure. I don't really have an answer as to why he chose to use that. Yeah.
I have a funny request.
Yeah.
Would you mind reciting one or two poems in Turkish, just reciting them for us? With their echo in our mind.
Well,
perhaps the last one.
I have Naili here.
Naili?
Yep.
Which is the last one on the handout.
Yemi ateş huruşi dilde oldukça sükun peyda. Eder her dahi hasret tende bir gird abi hun peyda. Bu alem pa taser kuh kuh i mihnet du gamdır. Eder her tişe kari arezu bir bisutun peyda. Giran etsün ko diller tar tar i zülfün olsun tek. Ruhun bağında nice müşk bid i serni gün peyda. Lebi şuhi nigahi çeşmün oldukça terenüm saz. Eder erçün bışı müjgâne bir nakşi füsun peyda. Bulubet gâh da ey naili bilmektedir hikmet. Ne zirri hırkadandır heft ta sinil gün peyda.
Thank you.